The Words We Live By. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the eighth in this series of 15 literary dialogues on democracy and the Bible, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Maurice, let me remind you that we promised ourselves long ago, it seems to me weeks ago, to say something about the year of Jubilee, that 50th year, that is to say, that came after the seven times seventh year, which was a very special sabbatical year, shall we say. Of course, they had a sabbatical year, but this is the sabbatical year of sabbatical years. I don't want to leave that altogether untouched in our discussions, because it seems to me that that gives us the egalitarian principle, the democratic principle, in its widest possible scope, its hugest outline. Would you agree?
Yes, I would say that we had there a fusion of civic wisdom and of spiritual insight into human relations, also with a touch of the mystical. In any case, the number seven is one of the early mystical numbers. It had to do with the seven heavenly bodies that were then known, and then the seventh part of a lunar month. There were 7 days in the week, so seven had a mystical number among all the nations of the Near East. And it was turned to advantage in the promulgation of laws or in the working out of a social system. And here in the Jubilee, you had the seven times seven, at the end of which a new deal, totally new deal, was proposed for the country, that debts should be cancelled and arrangements were made that a man should not contract a debt immediately before the Jubilee, because then it would not actually be a debt. There would be arrangements to that extent in order to counteract the effect of it. And in particular, the great phrase that rings in connection with the Jubilee is, "Proclaim liberty throughout the land, and to all the inhabitants thereof." To all the inhabitants. One might think that it included also the stranger. We don't know. To all the inhabitants thereof. "And ye shall return every man unto his possession, and ye shall return every man unto his family." So that if it was obligatory to release a slave at the end of 7 years of ordinary service, then certainly in the time of the Jubilee, there was a double and complete obligation. And I don't know of a parallel elsewhere that there was a refreshing of the spirit of liberty in the country, a reassertion of the essential rights of human beings.
You probably know the old song of the slaves, written for them at any rate, long before the Civil War in this country, about the year of Jubilo. They call it the year of Jubilo for some reason or other. They like that vowel, O, rather than E. Do you know that song?
No. Is it one of the slave songs of the
year
before the...
Well, it was written by a person, but he represents the Negroes who sing it as looking forward with infinite longing to the year of Jubilo, when everything will be right, when there will be no masters and no slaves.
Well, there are so many references of that kind in the life of the Negro people. They're clinging to the idea of liberation. Let my people go.
Yes.
Go down, Moses, to Egypt land. Oh, let my people go. Having to do with the liberation of slaves.
Yes, there's hardly any critical moment, it seems to me, in the whole biblical story that the Negroes didn't appropriate to themselves, didn't use. I don't know how they knew the Bible so well, but they knew it in some very essential way, it seemed to me.
What a source of consolation it was to them.
Oh, tremendous.
How empty their lives would have been, and how devoid of any outlook. When you speak of Jubilee, I'm reminded that we were discussing the problem of slavery and of the mitigation of slavery, even among peoples that didn't know the Bible, and yet of the inferior quality of their attitude on that subject of the liberation of slaves. I think it's noted somewhere in one of the Roman writers, either Seneca or Cicero, that a slave could, by saving his peculium, as they called it, for 6 years, save enough to buy his freedom. They were allowed some kind of pay.
This was in Rome.
This was in Rome, and long after the Bible had been canonized, long after the books had been written and made sacred.
Oh, yes.
And it occurred to me in that connection that centuries before that, the Bible had written down that when a slave is to be freed, he shall not be sent away empty. That's in the 15th chapter of Deuteronomy.
Now, what does empty mean there?
He was told he must be given of the goods of the owner. He should be sent away with a generous present with which to start life anew.
Yes.
What a difference there is between that and the harsh, business-like Roman attitude. In 6 years, which is the same, by the way, as the Hebrew 6 years, serves for 6 years, and the seventh is liberated. But on the sixth year, everything is saved up, he gives to his boss, to his owner, he goes out and he's free. And here he's told, he shall not be sent away empty, but of the best thou shalt give him.
Yeah.
Send him away with sheep, possessions, clothes, so that he can begin life as a man established in society.
Yes. Well, to take one last look then at the year of Jubilee, it seems to me the significance for us in this summer's talks is that it sheds almost the highest and strongest light upon a deep instinct among the Jews to consider that the inequalities of circumstance, the inequalities that accrue to life somehow or other as it is lived, from time to time should be erased. Just as every seventh day, equality, as it were, came back. And every seventh year in the sabbatical year. So now in this grand, on this grand
that's
scale.
That's a very nice way of putting it, Mark. You know what it makes me think of? It's as though all of these inequalities are dirt.
That's
now
right.
Every seventh year, go and wash yourself and be
that's
yourself.
Right. Be cleansed.
And every 50th year, take a complete bath and come out as you were originally intended to be. And then someday the world will be without dirt. You won't have to do any washing.
Yes.
But this is only part of the whole range of subjects we have to consider under the aspect of Bible as, I won't say opposed, but counterpoised to democracy, a variety of human relations. There are things that democracy as a concept doesn't seem to cover or has only a tangential relation to that the Bible is very specific about and which I consider ultimately to be of the essence of democracy. For instance, we say it's undemocratic for a man to be a snob.
Yeah.
We use the word undemocratic. Or to be a show-off, or to be curt and superior with somebody. But do we say it's undemocratic for a man to be a glutton? Or don't we say, if I am now to take the role of the advocatus diaboli that you took the other day, don't we say, well, it's a democratic country, he has the right to be a glutton if he wants to?
Mm-hmm. That's true. We don't consider those as sins against democracy, do we?
No. But they are?
Of course they are.
In the last sense?
Of course they are, since they disable a person, since they make him less than he was, less good, less useful, less happy and healthy than he was, they render him to that extent less fit to take his place.
Well, then, perhaps, would you agree with this, let's call it tentative evaluation, that democracy places a limit or implies a limit on one's obligations to society? Supposing a man wants to be lazy and neglectful of his own capacities, indifferent to self-education. That's his right in a democracy.
You mean in a democracy
as we now understand it? As we still, in our imperfect evolution of the word, evaluate it, we say, that's his right. Whereas...
You mean he can waste his life if he wants
to? He can waste his life, whereas... we would say when we have advanced our democratic evolution to a further stage, no, we must so behave toward him that we discourage him from being indifferent to self-education, that we have an affirmative obligation to see to it that the best that is in him should be brought out for his sake as well as for our sake.
And we should like to think that he himself desired that, too, that it would be unthinkable that he would ever desire anything else.
It brings me back to the problem with which we started out. Can democracy flourish without these, what I would call, religious ethical attitudes that we've been discussing, which contain in themselves a dynamism which democracy, without a religious impulse behind it, would not contain?
That's right. You can use the word, it might seem strange, you can use the phrase mere justice. Now, of course, I dare say I shouldn't say mere justice, because justice is a very great thing, and no one has ever doubted it. The absence of justice is one of the most horrible things that you can conceive.
Yes.
And yet if...
When you read that passage last week from...
From Gissing.
From Gissing. It's a very striking thing that...
Yes. All right. Justice, of course, is a thing of the vastest dimension and depth. And yet, we can sometimes talk about mere justice. It's just right that this should be done. It's just proper that this should be done according to some view of our life, which is limited. And being limited does not take into view this glorious source which we are trying to recover here in our conversations this year. For instance, I remember you saying the other day, and I hadn't known this, that in Hebrew, justice is the same word as charity.
Yes. There was no distinction in their minds between the loving attitude which we understand by charity, and for which there would be another word, say chesed in Hebrew, and doing justice to somebody. You can't do justice to somebody in the Hebrew concept merely by weighing the pros and cons of the legal definitions of so-and-so's rights and so-and-so's rights. This is, well, you know, the Hebrews would have a very bitter phrase about these exactitudes. Those were the characteristics of Sodom and Gomorrah, mm-hmm. that they would weigh precisely this, that, as the limit, and there was no love in it.
Well,
so
yeah.
That love and justice are inextricably intertwined in the Jewish concept of, in the Hebraic, the biblical concept of the relationship between human beings.
Well, Maurice, that seems to me of the utmost importance. If I were asked... which are the more powerful thing, justice or love, I would probably say love was the more powerful and the greater thing. And yet, if I can imagine, as you now tell me to imagine, a people for whom love and justice were somehow inextricably mixed, then I think we have something like perfection. You know, I think we must understand how regularly... the writers of the Bible, and presumably the readers of it, thought of love as always somehow present. The reason we should be just to this man is that we love him. You know, you're bound to be just to someone that you love. You don't know how to be anything else.
Well, you know,
the love of men for one another as brothers is a more powerful conception, it seems to me, than purely political or purely social
yes.
justice.
There's been a long... and very deep-going debate, not only in the Jewish world, everywhere, I suppose, on the question of the relationship between justice and love. I'm going to tell you a story that occurs to me now and ask you, after giving you my reaction, what yours is. The story told of a rabbi who was sitting one day very early in the morning at his window studying the Talmud. This was before he had said his prayers, and it was before he had any public duties to perform, reading the Talmud, and he suddenly glanced up through the window and saw a thief making off with his firewood. It belonged to the rabbi, whereupon he flung open the window and shouted a Hebrew word, hefker, which implied, the wood doesn't belong to anybody.
Hmm.
So that he released the thief from the sin of stealing.
Hmm.
Now, I am of two minds in this business, whether it was right for him to be so thoughtful of the thief's condition that he shouldn't commit a sin, that he should release the wood and therefore make it anybody's property, or whether it was wrong of him because their love had outrun the necessities of love and justice. It's a complicated... What kind of a reaction does that bring up in you?
Well, I think I'm moved by it. I think I like it very much indeed. He was an extraordinary man, even for a rabbi, wasn't he? Probably.
Yes. Yes.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have the story.
Yes.
If it were a routine thing, we wouldn't
yes,
have the story.
Yes, it is a Hasidic story. But the question I ask myself is, it reminds me, I think we were having, was it last night we were discussing this, a man, was it the, I think it was a Japanese custom you told me, of a man wouldn't do another man a favor in order not to place him under an obligation,
which
would be a disfavor.
That's right.
But in not doing them a favor, he was doing them a favor because thereby he didn't place him under an obligation. Therefore, and so it goes on forever and ever, in what they call in mathematics one of these recessive solutions.
Well,
now, here in this problem of this rabbi and this thief, shouldn't the thief be told he mustn't do that sort of thing?
I think he was told. I think that's the point. I think as the thief went away with the wood and heard these words, he knew everything that he needed to know.
Well, I never thought of it.
He probably...
I never thought of it.
Probably 10 feet farther he dropped the wood.
Well, I never thought of that.
Yeah, not
although I got, the impression, perhaps the thief would say, what a sucker.
I'm not sure. No.
Then you're right. I take that back. You must do the right thing. Even the man's going to say, what a sucker.
Oh, of course.
It was the thing to do.
You must always be willing to be a sucker.
Yes.
I've always remembered G.K. Chesterton's remark. He said, whenever a man says to me, I have never been taken in, I say to myself, how lonely he must be.
Yes.
That's a pun.
But then, yes. Of course, there are people who say, the first time a man swindles me, it's my fault. The second time, it's his fault. The second time he does it, it's my fault. That's a pretty hard, harsh thing, as you're always on the alert. A man fooled you once, and then you were always on the alert against him. Well, these are actually the problems that arise out of the purely human, intimate, organic, penetrative relationship that the Bible teaches us with regard to human beings. Something completely remote from what I would be inclined to call the card index system of the modern world with regard to human beings. You'll take a man, you'll have his characteristics written down, he comes for employment, you flip the index, runs through maybe 10 or 15,000 electrical currents, there's the man. This is what the Bible opposes.
Yes. Yes, the Bible holds on to the belief that every person is inviolable, is a person, different from every other person, and yet like every other person in that he's created in God's image. Oh, yes, to me it's a very dreary world sometimes, it seems to me, that we live in. It's a world of personnel. It's a world where there's a science of choosing and selecting men. Other than the only method, it seems to me, that works, namely human judgment. Instead of my sitting down and talking to you and deciding in my own mind whether you would work well with me or whatnot, I'm supposed to ask everybody else and write down their answers. And I have a big sheet of paper on which there are lots of answers, and those are scrambled together, and finally...
They are processed.
Processed.
Yeah. Like a sausage.
If I may be highly personal, I'll never forget the time 10 years ago when this program was being conceived, and they had, the Jewish Theological Seminary had found you to be one of two or three conversants, and by some happy chance I was asked to come one day to meet with them, with the committee of the seminary and you, to talk about whether I was suitable and whether there might be a third person. I remember, I'll never forget, within 2 minutes of our beginning to talk, well, you said, you thumped the table and you said...
We clicked.
Yes, this is the man I want to talk to. We don't need a third person. I can talk to him forever. Well, we've been talking almost forever, haven't we?
Well, some of the listeners might think
But that was a judgment on your part. I mean, you didn't consult. You had no papers about me. You hadn't investigated me.
Well, I must say, frankly, I knew your book on Shakespeare. Well, I knew some of your poetry.
Right.
I didn't know what you were like as a person.
And well, I know, but these things...
But the meeting, yes, I suppose that if they had been scientific... they would have chosen my name or your name to begin with, and then they'd have run through a long series of corridors, you know, like those lights they show you, the branching lines of a telephone exchange. Finally comes plop, there's the person for him. And we would have, in the course of 10 years, produced a number of plop, plop, plop conversations, which have gone down into the plop, plop records. Instead of which, we're here having a good time.
Maurice, let
which me... Which may be more than our listeners are having.
Let me tell you a story, too. Not many years ago, I was in Nashville, Tennessee, at Fisk University, and I was invited to go to the auditorium of the university to hear Martin Luther King address a congregation almost entirely of Negroes. There were a few white persons there, including myself, but we were... Well, he was talking to the Negro students and faculty of that university. Well, he was talking, as you can imagine, about the thing that he's been most concerned with, namely the... we're talking about human relations. He was going to talk about the relations between the Negro people and the white people in this country. And he said, in a manner that I shall never forget, and with a dignity that I shall never forget, said, "My friends, I'm here to tell you that you must learn to love the white people. You may never like them, but you must love them." Now, he said, "I may never be able to like Senator Eastland of Mississippi, but I must learn to love him."
Yes, well, he was placing an almost superhuman program before people.
Yeah, but why not
it
superhuman?
But I say it is tremendously difficult. It is difficult to grasp intellectually. And I suppose even more difficult to fulfill in one's emotions.
Well, by the way, you say difficult intellectually. He is a philosopher by training, an excellent philosopher, and he talked this out in terms of philosophy so that it became a very serious statement by him. It wasn't just idly said. No, this is the only way to do it, he said. This is the only way that we can live with one another. We must love one another. I think love and justice, in his mind, by the way, were being equated.
Well,
don't you think so?
Well, yes.
Social justice.
Yes. Now, it calls back to me the verse in Micah, which everybody knows, or anybody's at all acquainted with the Bible, as to what is expected of the human being. "He hath shown thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but... to do justly and to love mercy."
That's right.
"And to walk humbly with thy God." But to do justly and to love mercy, these are taken together, that justice and mercy and the love of mercy are inextricably intertwined. You cannot apparently exercise the one in the absence of the other.
That's right.
Justice then would even mean in... justice to myself, which is so frequently a cant phrase for the imposition of one's egotism on somebody else. In justice to myself, I must act thus and thus, and in love of you, I must act thus and thus. The two of them going together as naturally as the two sides of a shield must be there in order to complete the shield.
Of course, isn't it true, Maurice, that to love someone is to... give him something that he hasn't necessarily earned. We don't love people according to their desert, do we? We just love them, period.
Well, that would not be love. That would be alter egotism, is right. What the philosophers call it. To love in somebody else that which you love in yourself is simply an extension of your own ego, as when parents show off a child and thereby show off themselves. Or there's another instance I once adverted to, I don't know whether it's in one of our talks, Nabal. You remember the coarse, brutish husband of Abigail.
Of Abigail.
He loved to feed people. And the reason he loved it was because he himself, not being able to consume an ox at a sitting, but having the inclination to do so, unable to drink a hogshead of wine, he engaged people to eat it for him. It was an extension of his capacity to eat and drink.
Yeah.
He loved those people as he loved himself because they were doing this for him. Now, this is not love of a person, love of somebody else. It is, I referred to it before, as alter egoism or alter egotism.
Is there such a thing, by the way, in this whole field for you as progress or change? We have talked, to be sure, about an evolution within the Bible of certain concepts, and we've talked about how an evolution continues to go on. In what sense, however, does the word progress have importance to you? The word troubles me sometimes.
Yes. It's used so glibly. We imply by progress that if we have so many more cars and roads in operation, we have made progress. And also, a little more generously, that if there are fewer people starving, we have made progress.
Yes, but it often takes this form. Are people better today than they used to be? Is the world getting better? And they don't have to mean by that getting more physically comfortable, but are people getting better? To me, that's a very barren question, because I know of so many very ancient times and places where people were extremely good, as well as extremely evil, and I know that's true now. What are we talking about here when we talk about the Bible, except a book in which the extremes of good and evil existed somehow or other, and how the very purest and finest ideas were had extremely early.
Well, this is an extremely important thought you've suddenly thrown in, Mark. Sort of unbalances me and sends me off in new directions. The relationship between progress and democracy. What do we mean by progress and democracy? What do we mean by progress in the Bible? We agreed, I think, several weeks ago, that in the Bible there is an evolutionary forward movement, which we would therefore call progress. And we also talked of progress in democracy. But there's a difference in spirit between the forward movement as conceived in the one or as conceived in the other. And perhaps we might make a little digression and start our next talk with some reflections that we could shark up between us on progress, democracy, progress, and the Bible.
I should like to do that because sometimes I've been troubled by the suspicion that our listeners might think that we suppose there was a steady progression of some sort from one point to another, whereas I know that good men have been miracles at any time. You know, we talk about the problem of evil. The problem of good is just as hard to solve, isn't it? Why is somebody good? There's no reason, is there? Except that he is. Well, that has always been possible.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the 8th in the 15-week Eternal Light Summer Series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of democracy and the Bible. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. This is the NBC Radio Network.